the duration of the faith. Venerable Nagasena, it has been said by the Blessed One, but now the good law, Ananda, will only stand fast for 500 years. But on the other hand, the Blessed One declared just before his death, in response to the question put by Subhadra the recluse, but if in this system the brethren live the perfect life, then the world will not be bereft of arahats. This last phrase is absolute, inclusive. It cannot be explained away. If the first of these statements be correct, the second is misleading. If the second be right, the first must be false. This too is a double-pointed question, more confused than the jungle, more powerful than a strong man, more knotty than a knot. It is now put to you, show the extent of the power of your knowledge, like a leviathan in the midst of the sea. The Blessed One, O King, did make both statements you have quoted, but they are different one from the other, both in the spirit and in the letter. The one deals with the limit of the duration of the doctrine, the other with the practice of a religious life. Two things widely distinct, as far removed from one the other as the zenith is from the surface of the earth. As heaven is from purgatory, as good is from evil, and as pleasure is from pain. But though that be so, yet lest your inquiry should be vain, I will expound the matter further in its essential connection. When the Blessed One said that the good law would only endure for 500 years, he said so declaring the time of its destruction, limiting the remainder of its existence. For he said, the good law, Ananda, would endure for 1,000 years if no woman had been admitted to the order. But now, Ananda, it will only last 500 years. But in so saying, O King, did the Blessed One either foretell the disappearance of the good law, or throw blame on the clear understanding thereof? Certainly not, sir. Just so, it was a declaration of injury done, an announcement of the limit of what remained, as when a man whose income had been diminished might announce publicly, making sure of what remained. So much property have I lost, so much is still left. So did the Blessed One make known to gods and men what remained when he announced what had been lost by saying, the good law will now, Ananda, endure for 500 years. In so saying, he was fixing a limit to religion. But when in speaking to Subhadra, and by way of proclaiming who were the true Samanas, he said, but if in this system the brethren live the perfect life, then the world will not be bereft of arahats. In so saying, he was declaring in what religion consisted. You have confounded the limitation of a thing with the statement of what it is. But if you like, I will tell you what the real connection between the two is. Listen carefully and attend trustfully to what I say. Suppose, O King, there were a reservoir quite full of fresh cool water, overflowing at the brim, but limited in size and with an embankment running all around it. Now if, when the water had not abated in that tank, a mighty cloud were to rain down rain continually and in addition on to the water already in it, would the amount of water in the tank decrease or come to an end? Certainly not, sir. But why not, O King? Because of the continual downpour of the rain. Just so, O King, is the glorious reservoir of the good law of the teaching of the conqueror, ever full of the clear, fresh, cool water of the practice of duty and virtue and morality and purity of life, and continues overflowing all limits even to the very highest heaven of heavens. And if the children of the Buddha rain down into it continuously, and in addition the rainfall of still further practice of duty and virtue and morality and purity of life, then will it endure for long, and the world will not be bereft of arhats. This was the meaning of the Master's words when he said, "But if, Subhadda, in this system the brethren continue in perfectness of life, then will the world not be bereft of arhats." Now suppose again, O King, that people were to continually apply a mighty fiery furnace with dry cow dung and dry sticks and dry leaves. Would that fire go out? No, indeed, sir. Rather would it blaze more fiercely and burn more brightly. Just so, O King, does the glorious teaching of the conqueror blaze and shine over the 10,000 world systems by the practice of duty and virtue and morality and purity of life. And if, O King, in addition to that, the children of the Buddha, devoting themselves to the five kinds of spiritual exertion, continue zealous in effort, if cultivating a longing for the threefold discipline, they train themselves therein, if without ceasing they carry out to the full the conduct that is right, and absolutely avoid all that is wrong, and practice righteousness of life, then will this glorious doctrine of the conqueror stand more and more steadfast as the years roll on, and the world will not be bereft of arhats. It was in reference to this, O King, that the Master spake, when he said, "But if, Subhadda, in this system the brethren continue in perfectness of life, then will the world not be bereft of arhats." Again, O King, suppose people were to continually polish with fine soft red powder a stainless mirror that was already bright and shining, well polished, smooth, and glossy, would dirt and dust and mud arise on its surface? No, indeed, sir. Rather would it become to a certainty even more stainless than before. Just so, O King, is the glorious doctrine of the conqueror stainless by nature and altogether free from the dust and dirt of evil. And if the children of the Buddha cleanse it by the virtue arising from the shaking off, the eradication of evil, from the practice of duty and virtue and morality and purity of life, then will this glorious doctrine endure for long, and the world will not be bereft of arhats. It was in reference to this that the Blessed One spake when he said, "But if, Subhadda, in this system the brethren continue in righteousness of life, then will not the world be bereft of arhats. For the teaching of the Master, O King, has its roots in conduct, has conduct as its essence, and stands fast so long as conduct does not decline." Venerable Nagasena, when you speak of the disappearance of the good law, what do you mean by its disappearance? There are three modes of the disappearance, O King, of a system of doctrine. And what are the three? The decline of attainment to an intellectual grasp of it, the decline of conduct in accordance with it, and the decline of its outward form. When the attainment of it ceases, then even the man who conducts himself aright in it has no clear understanding of it. By the doctrine of conduct, the promulgation of the rules of discipline ceases. Only the outward form of the religion remains. When the outward form has ceased, the succession of the tradition is cut off. These are the three forms of the disappearance of a system of doctrine. You have well explained, Venerable Dhammasena, this dilemma so profound. You have made it plain. You have loosed the knot. You have destroyed the arguments of the adversary, broken them in pieces, proved them wrong. You, O best of the leaders of schools. Here ends the dilemma as to the duration of the faith. The Buddha's sinlessness. Venerable Nagasena, had the Blessed One, when he became a Buddha, burnt out all evil in himself, or was there still some evil remaining in him? He had burnt out all evil. There was none left. But how, sir? Did not the Tathagata get hurt in his body? Yes, O King. At Ragagaha, a splinter of rock pierced his foot, and once he suffered from dysentery. And once, when the humors of his body were disturbed, a purge was administered to him. And once, when he was troubled with wind, the elder who waited on him, that is Ananda, gave him hot water. Then, sir, if the Tathagata, on his becoming a Buddha, has destroyed all evil in himself, this other statement, that his foot was pierced by a splinter, that he had dysentery, and so on, must be false. But if they are true, then he cannot have been free from evil. For there is no pain without karma. All pain has its roots in karma. It is on account of karma that suffering arises. This double-headed dilemma is put to you, and you have to solve it. No, O King. It is not all suffering that has its root in karma. There are 8 causes by which suffering arise, by which many beings suffer pain. And what are the 8? Superabundance of wind, and of bile, and of phlegm. The union of these humors, variations in temperature, the avoiding of dissimilarities, external agency, and karma. From each of these, there are some sufferings that arise, and these are the 8 causes by which many beings suffer pain. And therein whosoever maintains that it is karma that injures beings. And besides it, there is no other reason for pain. His proposition is false. But sir, all the other 7 kinds of pain, have each of them also karma as its origin? For they are all produced by karma. If, O King, all diseases were really derived from karma, then there would be no characteristic marks by which they could be distinguished one from the other. When the wind is disturbed, it is so in one or other of 10 ways, by cold or by heat, or by hunger, or by thirst, or by overeating, or by standing too long, or by overexertion, or by walking too fast, or by medical treatment, or as a result of karma. Of these 10, 9 do not act in a past life or in a future life, but in one's present existence. Therefore, it is not right to say that all pain is due to karma. When the bile, O King, is deranged, it is so in one or other of 3 ways, by cold, by heat, or by improper food. When the phlegm is disturbed, it is so by cold, or by heat, or by food and drink. When either of these 3 humors are disturbed or mixed, it brings about its own special distinctive pain. Then there are the special pains arising from variations in temperature, avoidance of dissimilarities and external agency. And there is the act that has karma as its fruit, and the pain so brought about arising from the act done. So what arises as the fruit of karma is much less than that which arises from other causes. And the ignorant go too far when they say that every pain is produced as the fruit of karma. No one without a Buddha's insight can fix the extent of the action of karma. Now when the Blessed One's foot was torn by a splinter of rock, the pain that followed was not produced by any other of the eight causes I have mentioned, but only by external agency. For Devadatta, O King, had harbored hatred against the Tathagata during a succession of hundreds of thousands of births. It was in his hatred that he seized hold of a mighty mass of rock and pushed it over with the hope that it would fall upon his head. But two other rocks came together and intercepted it before it had reached the Tathagata, and by the force of the impact a splinter was torn off and fell upon the Blessed One's foot and made it bleed. Now this pain must have been produced in the Blessed One either as a result of his own karma or of someone else's act. But beyond these two, there can be no other kind of pain. It is also when a seed does not germinate that must be due either to the badness of the soil or to a defect in the seed. Or it is as when food is not digested that must be due either to a defect in the stomach or to the badness of the food. But although the Blessed One never suffered pain which was the result of his own karma, or brought about the avoidance of dissimilarity, yet he suffered pain from each of the other six causes, and by the pain he could suffer, it was not possible to deprive him of life. There come to this body of ours, O King, compounded of the four elements, sensations desirable and the reverse, pleasant and unpleasant. Suppose, O King, a clod of earth were to be thrown into the air and to fall again onto the ground. Would it be in consequence of any act it had previously done that it would so fall? No, sir. There is no reason in the broad earth by which it could experience the result of an act, either good or evil. It would be by reason of a present cause, independent of karma, that the clod would fall into earth again. Well, O King, the Tathagata should be regarded as the broad earth, and as the clod would fall on it irrespective of any act done by it, so also was it irrespective of any act done by him that the splinter of rock fell upon his foot. Again, O King, men tear up and plow the earth, but is that a result of any act previously done? Certainly not, sir. Just so, with the falling of that splinter, and the dysentery which attacked him was in the same way the result of no previous act. It arose from the union of these humors, and whatsoever bodily disease fell upon him, that had its origin not in karma, but in one or other of the six causes referred to, for it has been said, O King, by the Blessed One, by Him who is above all gods, in the glorious collection called after Moliya Sivaka, there are certain pains which arise in the world, Sivaka, from bilious humor, and you ought to know for a certainty which those are, for it is a matter of common knowledge in the world which they are. But those Samanas and Brahmins, Sivaka, who are of the opinion and proclaim the view that whatsoever pleasure or pain or indifferent sensation any man experiences is always due to a previous act. They go beyond certainty, they go beyond knowledge, and therein do I say they are wrong. And so also of those pains which arise from the phlegmatic humor, or from the windy humor, or from the union of the tree, or from variation in temperature, or from avoidance of dissimilarity, or from external action, or as the result of karma, in each case you should know for a certainty which those are, for it is a matter of common knowledge which they are. But those samanas or brahmins who are of the opinion or the view that whatsoever pleasure or pain or indifferent sensation any man may experience, that is always due to a previous act. They go beyond certainty, they go beyond common knowledge, and therein do I say they are wrong. So, O King, it is not all pain that is a result of karma, and you should accept as a fact that when the Blessed One became a Buddha, he had burnt out all evil from within him.
Very good, Nagasena. It is so, and I accept it as you say.
Here ends the dilemma as to the Buddha's sinlessness. On the advantages of meditation. Venerable Nagasena, your people say that everything which a Tathagata has to accomplish, that had the Blessed One already carried out, when he sat at the foot of the Tree of Wisdom, there was then nothing that he had yet to do, nothing that he had to add to what he had already done. But when there is also talk of his having immediately afterwards remained plunged for 3 months in ecstatic contemplation, if the first statement be correct, then the second must be false, and if the second be right, then the first must be wrong. There is no need of any contemplation to find who has already accomplished this task. It is the man who still has something left to do who has to think about it. It is the sick man who has need of medicine, not the healthy, the hungry man who has need of food, not the man whose hunger is quenched. This too is a double-headed dilemma, and you have to solve it. Both statements, O King, are true. Contemplation has many virtues. All the Tathagatas attained in contemplation to Buddhahood and practiced it in the recollection of its good qualities, and they did so in the same way as a man who had received high office from a king would. In the recollection of its advantages, of the prosperity he enjoyed by means of it, remained constantly in attendance on that king. In the same way as a man who, having been afflicted and pained with a dire disease, and having recovered his health by the use of medicine, would use the same medicine again and again, once calling to mind its virtue. And there are, O King, these 28 good qualities of meditation, in the perception of which the Tathagatas devoted themselves to it. And which are they? Meditation preserves him who meditates. It gives him long life and endows him with power. It cleanses him from faults. It removes from him any bad reputation, giving him a good name. It destroys discontent in him, filling him with content. It releases him from awe, fear, endowing him with confidence. It removes sloth far from him, filling him with zeal.
It takes away lust and ill will and dullness. It puts an end to pride. It breaks down all doubt. It makes his heart to be at peace. It softens his mind. It makes him glad. It makes him grave. It gains him much advantage. It makes him worthy of reverence. It fills him with joy. It fills him with delight. It shows him the transitory nature of all compounded things. It puts an end to rebirth. It obtains for him all the benefits of renunciation. These, O King, are the 28 virtues of meditation, on the perception of which the Tathagatas devote themselves to it. But it is because the Tathagata, O King, long for the courtyard of the bliss of attainment, of the joy of the tranquil state of Nirvana, that they devote themselves to meditation with their minds fixed on the end they aim at. And there are four reasons for which the Tathagatas, O King, devote themselves to meditation. And what are the four? That they may dwell at ease, O King, and on account of the abundance of the advantages of meditation. Advantages without drawback, and on account of its being the road to all noble things without exception, and because it has been praised and lauded and exalted and magnified by all the Buddhas. These are the reasons for which the Tathagatas devote themselves to it. So it is not, great king, because they have anything left to do or anything to add to what they have already accomplished, but because they have perceived how diversified are the advantages it possesses, that they devote themselves to meditation.
Very good, Nagasena. That is so, and I accept it as you say. Here ends the dilemma as to meditation.
Venerable Nagasena, it has been said by the Blessed One, the Tathagata, Ananda, has thought out and thoroughly practiced, developed, accumulated, and ascended to the very height of the four paths to saintship, and so mastered them as to be able to use them as a means of mental advancement and as a basis for edification. And he therefore, Ananda, should he desire it, might remain alive for a kalpa, or for that portion of a kalpa which had yet to run. And again he said, at the end of 3 months from this time, the Tathagata will die. If the first of these statements were true, then the limit of 3 months must have been false. If the second were true, then the first must have been false. For the Tathagatas boast not without an occasion. The blessed Buddhas speak no misleading words, but they utter truth, and speak sincerely. This too is a double-headed dilemma, profound, subtle, hard to expound. It is now put to you. Tear in sunder this net of heresy. Put it on one side. Break in pieces the arguments of the adversary. Both these statements, O King, were made by the Blessed One. But kalpa in that connection means the duration of a man's life. And the Blessed One, O King, was not exalting his own power when he said so, but he was exalting the power of saintship. It was as if a king were possessed of a horse most swift of foot, who could run like the wind. And in order to exalt the power of his speed, the king were to say in the presence of all his court townsfolk and countryfolk, hired servants and men of war, Brahmins, nobles and officers, if he wished it, this noble steed of mine could cross the earth to its ocean boundary and be back here again in a moment. Now though He did not try to test the horse's speed in the presence of the court, yet it had that speed and was really able to go along over the earth to its ocean boundary in a moment. Just so, O King, the Blessed One spake as he did in praise of the power of saintship, and so spake seated in the midst of gods and men. And of the men of the threefold wisdom and the sixfold insight, the Arahats, pure and free from stain, when he said, the Tathagata Ananda has thought out and practiced, developed, accumulated, and ascended to the very height of the four powers of saintship, and so mastered them as to be able to use them as a means of mental advancement, as a basis for edification. And he therefore, Ananda, should he desire it, might remain alive for a kalpa, or the part of a kalpa that has yet to run. And there was that power, O King, in the Tathagata. He could have remained alive for that time, and yet he did not show that power in the midst of that assembly. The Blessed One, O King, is free from desire as respects all conditions of future life, and has condemned them all. For it has been said, O King, by the Blessed One, dust, O bhikkhus, is a very small quantity of excrement, is of evil smell. So do I find no beauty in the very smallest degree of future life, not even in such for the time of the snapping of the fingers. Now would the Blessed One, O King, who thus looked upon all sorts and conditions of future life as dung, have nevertheless simply because of his power of iti harbored a craving desire for future life? Certainly not, sir. Then it must have been to exalt the power of iti that he gave utterance to such a boast. Very good, Nagasena. It is so, and I accept it as you say. Here ends the dilemma as to the 3 months. Here ends the first chapter.